Okay, is this microphone on? Yep. Okay, good. All right, let's get started. So before we get to the lecture material, I just wanted to go through a few things to do with the first part of the assignment, which you should all have back by now. So one of the things that a lot of people seem to have a little bit of confusion might be too strong a word for it, but not complete clarity about is this word packages. So packages was used in the coursework handout to mean something like, you know, one of the SourceForge projects. But packages has a specific meaning in Java. A Java package is a specific kind of thing. And one of the things that you need to do in understanding any of the projects that you're looking at is understand the Java package structure. So the essential, I mean, I went through packages a little bit in a previous lecture, but essentially what packages are about is namespaces. So Java files are grouped together in a folder, and all of the Java files in that folder will have the same package name, which is the same name as the folder. So one of the things people did was talk about the folder structure of their project and not kind of distinguish that completely from the package structure. So the folder structure includes things like images and, you know, all sorts of other things that you might need, but the packages are a particular kind of thing. The essence of packages is that they allow you to use the same names for classes or methods in different packages, and they're qualified by the package name, which means that different people can work on them without worrying about naming conflicts. So one of the things you all need to make sure you do understand, if you don't already, is what a Java package is and how it all works. And we'll take a quick look at a couple of examples in a minute. All of the IDEs will show you the package structure. Eclipse will show you the package structure. If the project has a complete set of Java docs, then you can see the package structure in the Java docs. So we'll take a look at some of those. In terms of contributions, a fair number of people didn't mention either unit tests or adding Java doc, which, you know, isn't necessarily a problem. But it's, I just wanted to remind you, don't forget that those are two things that you can do. And if you do say add a new feature or fix some bugs, make sure that you write unit tests for those and Java doc for those, even if the rest of the project doesn't have any of that. So make sure that what you do is unit tested. And I'd like you to use JUnit. It's possible that some projects are not, you know, they're doing unit testing, but they're not using JUnit, and in which case you should use whatever unit testing framework they're using. So let's take a look at just quickly a couple of these. So this is Free Call, and what we're looking at here is the website for, so this is one that somebody picked. We're looking at the website for Free Calls. This isn't the SourceForge website, but if you go to documentation here, you can see. So here's an interesting piece of documentation: the repository layout. So this gives you a high-level view of what the structure of the project is already, and then it tells you, you know, how it's structured within each of those. So each of them have got their own trunk, tags, and branches. So the trunk is for the main version. The tags are how to distinguish between releases, and branches are, as we went through branches before. So, you know, that's kind of useful background for whoever's working on this. And here's the Java doc. And you can see here's the set of packages. So if the project has Java doc, then it's actually very easy to see the package structure and what they're all for. Okay, so That's that one. On SourceForge, if we go and look at that, so this is FreeCol again, this is on SourceForge. If you want to look at the source, you go to the develop page, and you can just browse the source. I'm sure almost all of you have already figured this out. So this is quite, this is a fairly large project, and it's going to be in here. So there's a whole bunch of other folders that are for different aspects of the project, but this is where you're going to find the source. And right, here we go. So here's the trunk, and here's the source, and here's the this is where the tests, any unit tests will be. So all of these other folders are, you know, relevant, but they're not where the source is going to be. And in particular, jars is going to hold external libraries that are used by this, and quite often that's called libs. So there's a standard structure to put all the source in something called SRC and put test in something called test, but the rest of the folder names are, you know, people usually use libs for where you put the external libraries, but it's not required. So if we take a look in here, you have to go down several levels to actually get to the source. So netsf, freecol, and finally we've got to some source. So if we take a look at this source file here, we can view it. Okay, so here's the code, and you can see here's the package that it's in. So it was net.sf.freecol, which was the directory structure that we went down to get to where this Java file is. So that's the package declaration. And every one of the Java files will have a package declaration. I think I did come across one project that somebody was looking at that is so small and simple that it doesn't actually have packages. But normally you would expect there to be packages. So that package related to, it was net.sf.freecol, and that's where this Java file is. So if we go down and look at, say, the client package, and then within, so here's a Java file here, and this one is going to have, it's going to be, the package is going to be net.sf.freecol.client. If it will load. Let's try something else. Okay, well, we got something there. Oops. Maybe we didn't. Okay, so net.sf.freecol.client. So as you go down the folder hierarchy, you're going down the package hierarchy. But as I said when I first talked about packages, the hierarchy doesn't have any meaning in terms of, you know, if you import something at one level, it doesn't mean you've necessarily, you don't inherit or in the way that you inherit in a Java class hierarchy. It's not that sort of hierarchy. Okay, so, and if we go down in here, you can see this has got you know, all sorts of sub-packages. So complicated projects will have quite a hierarchy of packages and sub-packages. So if we go back, we can take a quick look at the test. So that was source, and we can go into test, and again, we've got, it mirrors the, oh, wait a minute, something's not gone quite right there. Here we go, test source, and then it mirrors the original source directory. So here we have tests for the different sub-packages that are going to be in here. So if we look at client, you can see there's a set of tests and a set of sub-package tests in there. And if we looked at one of these, well, actually, I'm not going to go and look in any more detail. You can look at those kinds of things if you want to, but it's the same sort of structure that I showed you in the JUnit example. So I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say. The main thing is that the folder structure in some of these projects can be quite complex, and you're presented with a lot of them, and you don't necessarily have to understand exactly what's in everything. The thing that's really critical is understanding the source hierarchy and the test hierarchy. And depending on what you're doing, you may work on aspects of the code that use things that are in other hierarchies, like, for example, resources. So that was that. And then I wanted to show you, this is a much simpler project. So this is Clip Comrade 3, and if we look in here, for example, doesn't really matter too much where. We'll look at this Java file. So the previous project that we looked at, I didn't actually show you, but if we paid attention looking at the Java files, you would have seen that there was complete Java doc, and that's the reason that we were able to look at the Java doc on the website. Now, if we look at this, did I just open it? What happened there? So this doesn't have any Java doc, all right? It might have some comments somewhere, although I don't see any yet. So you can see this. If whoever's working on this one, I mean, one of the things that you could think about doing is adding some Java doc, which would be a really good thing to have. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the assignment. All right, let's go on to actually the content of this lecture. So this is the first of two lectures about software development processes. The next lecture is going to be about the agile development process, and I'd encourage you to go to the CompSoc talk on that, since it's you're going to be hearing about it next time. And what you'll probably, I don't exactly know what the talk's going to be about, but I imagine you'll probably hear more of a practical, story about how it's actually used in practice, whereas what I'll be telling you in the lecture is slightly from a more, academic perspective, and it's very good to have both of those. So today we're going to talk about non-agile processes, starting with what's known as the waterfall, and ending up with versions of the unified process. So this is a graphic of the waterfall model of software development taken from Wikipedia. So you can see that this is kind of a staged thing. And we've sort of talked about the different stages that you can go through in software development that in a lot of ways mirrors this. So you gather your requirements, you do your design, you implement, then you do some testing to verify that it worked, and then the deployment is missed off there, but but then you have to do maintenance. You have, after it's deployed, you have to do maintenance. So it sort of makes sense. And you know, it's better than having no process whatsoever, because it makes clear that there are these different kind of steps and that there are, you know, there are distinct things and phases that you have to go through. But in practice, it's you know, it's not really very realistic. So for example, when you go to do testing, it can show up that the requirements didn't make sense. You know, you failed to gather some requirement. And that was one of the reasons why writing tests early or even before any implementation is a good idea, because it helps with that earlier phase of requirements gathering. And if you adopt this kind of waterfall model, which people don't adopt anymore, but anything like it, then you tend to try to anticipate all the things that problems you might get later when you say you do testing or you deploy it, by building in all sorts of functionality that you think you might need, and that becomes then very expensive. And actually this term, this kind of diagram, this term were introduced back in 1970 in a paper, but it was a paper that was criticizing this as a bad idea. It's not like somebody wrote a paper saying this is the way software engineering should be done. Nobody has ever actually promoted this as a way of doing things. However, slightly more sensible versions of this have been promoted and are still used. So it's not, it's worth understanding it. So the related process that is used is some version of something called a spiral model. So a spiral model, you can imagine you're sort of circling around you want to be in at the middle where the final delivered product that works, that the customer wants and, you know, is maintainable is. And you sort of circle around, homing in on it. So the idea in a spiral model is that you split the project into a set of iterations, and each iteration is like one of those waterfalls. So that's good because it should reduce the risk. So you do something early to check the user requirements and you try things out. So you don't commit to a whole lot of development work before you've made some tried some ideas out. But it's expensive because you have to do repeated testing. Got lots of documentation. You have to, do the full documentation at every step in terms of requirements and so on. And some projects are so small or they're so low risk that it's not worth iterating. You also need time to just rework what's previously been done, refactoring, and that's not kind of built into the model. There isn't any place in the diagram for that. And if you have a very big project, different kinds of big project need different sorts of iterations. So it's not really a very usable in many cases. So those were two sort of fairly early ideas, and over time the software development process has gone through a number of phases of how people think it's best to do it, and of which agile methods are the latest. But this more heavy duty kind of design oriented way of doing things culminated in something called the unified process, and the first sort of steps towards it were with Ivar Jacobson, who was at Ericsson and did component-based development and block diagrams for architectures back in, starting in the 60s, so really quite early, when computers were very small and systems weren't very big. And he founded something called Objectory, in the 80s and ran that company into the 90s, adding use cases. In 95, he got together with two other people, Grady Booch and Jim Rumbaugh, and the three of them formed Rational, which bought Objectrix. These are all companies. And they basically, they'd been kind of competing. The three of them had been competing with different, sort of similar but slightly different versions of how software engineering, how the process should work. And they basically got together and said, okay, let's just, you know, form one front and we'll all agree. And so they came up with the first version of what they called the unified method. And at the same time, UML was being developed. And UML quickly kind of got a lot more adherence. And although UML isn't a development process, it's obviously you know, closely related to development processes. So they added controlled iteration later, and then in 98 they came out with the unified process, which we'll go into a little bit in some slides. But one of the aspects of the unified process is that it uses UML for all the design diagrams. And so the unified process is kind of in the public domain. It's a you know, has generic ideas in it, and lots of people use it. The company Rational developed a lot of support tools and created something called the Rational Unified Process, which is commonly known as RUP, R-U-P. And you'll come across lots of software engineers who will say, oh yeah, I know, I'm familiar with the RUP process. So that was a more detailed version of the unified process, and commercial. So, you know, you had to buy it, and it came with a whole lot of support and so on. And Rational was bought in, I think, the 2003 or something like that by IBM. So it's now part of IBM. And there are lots of variants on it. But the general idea is encapsulated in this slide, which is taken from, some of these slides are taken from Rational. So you can see here some of the main features of the unified process. And this kind of brings together a lot of the different aspects of software engineering that we've talked about up till now. So you can see there's, where are we? There we go. So you can see it's, you know, driven by use cases. It's going to be iterative. It's going to focus on architecture, so architecture is going to play an important part, and it's going to be flexible, tailorable. And in the use case aspect of the system is to do with business needs and user requirements. So these are all things we've talked about. The focus on architecture allows you to think about reusing components and extensibility and so on. And iteration allows you to reduce major risks and you know, give users an early view of the system. So this is the kind of slide that on the one hand, you know, gives you a sort of a list of things that are part of this. On the other hand, I like to think of these slides as sometimes sort of content free. In fact, I worked for Hughes Aircraft for a while, and we had an annual competition for the best content-free slide that had been presented to management. And I think this probably would have featured. But with a bit of talking through, you can make something of these slides. Anyway, let's go on to something that's a bit more contentful. So one of the aspects of there are a whole lot of aspects to the unified process. One of them is the focus on what they call the four P's, which are process, project, product, and people. And the idea is that these are the really, really important aspects of successful software engineering. So the first thing is people. You know, people build the software, people evaluate it, people test it, people design it. You have to have a really good set of people if you're going to be successful. So that means it's not just that the people are good at what they do, but that the management is good at organizing things in a way that motivates everybody. So there are a lot of aspects that have nothing to do with what we think of as software engineering. They're nothing to do with coding or even technical design issues. They're people issues. The second is that the project is what ties the whole thing together. So, you know, that's why the people are there, because there's a project, and that's why you need a process, because you've got a project to do. The goal of the whole thing is to get a product out that people are going to use, so a focus on the product, a continual focus on the product is important, and you'll never get anywhere without a good process. And tools are kind of added on here as kind of a sub, you know, automated tools. We've seen some things like version control, configuration management. These all support the whole process part. So this probably seems, given everything that we've talked about so far, this probably doesn't seem, you know, kind of revolutionary in any sense. But at the time when this came out, which was, you know, the late 90s, it was a new thing to try and pull all this together. So another aspect of the unified process is that it incorporates four phases. And these are different from the steps in the waterfall diagram, and they don't really correspond to anything that we've talked about so far. So this is something new. The first phase in a project is called inception, and nothing to do with the movie. So the inception phase is, you know, at the beginning of the project, and it's to the point where whoever's sponsoring the project makes a commitment to actually go ahead. So large scale software engineering projects will typically they'll start, you know, somebody in an organization has an idea. It would be great if we had this sort of system, or we desperately need this sort of system. But to go from that idea to actually an organizational buy-in where lawyers have written contracts and that sort of thing is quite a long process. And that's what this inception phase is about. So it includes developing the business case. You know, it's all very well for somebody to say, yeah, we really need such and such, but you know, a business case will say, well, if we don't have it, here are the costs we're going to incur. You know, we won't get these customers, or you know, we won't be able to bid for this business, or you know, we won't be able to execute properly. So some sort of, you know, what are the bad things if we don't do this? What are the positives if we do it? And some sort of study of feasibility and scope. So you can already tell from this that we're talking about fairly large scale projects. The second phase is elaboration, and that is taking the original idea and what's been developed in the inception phase and building it up into the full design of the system. So you've got an architecture for the system, a plan for how you're going to build it. You've identified lots of the risks involved. All is probably a bit too optimistic, but you've probably got, you know, you've got the big ones anyway, you hope. And so, in other words, you're confident that you're going to be able to deliver this. And then the next phase is construction, and that's definitely something that requires multiple iterations, and that ends with a beta release of the system. So, you know, this is the kind of conceptualized version. And you know, we've spent probably quite a bit of the time recently on this sort of construction phase. How do you actually do that? And we earlier on in the course, when we were looking at requirements, you know, we were looking at some of this and some of this kind of phase. And then the fourth phase is transition. So that's once the system's constructed, how do you bring it to the users? How do you deploy it, train them, make sure that you've got the right kind of maintenance in place, and so on. So those are the four phases for the unified process. And you can think of this, kind of comparing them with this kind of straw man or the waterfall model. If we have, kind of time along this dimension, so, number of iterations in the project or the amount of time spent in it, and up here, how risky it is, the waterfall model stays at a high level of risk because you don't actually, until you start getting it out in front of users, or until you've built a fair bit of it and you know you can do it and you start getting it in front of users, you're not reducing your risk. And obviously, it's a, you look at this diagram, that's a kind of dangerous point to get to, because you've spent a lot of money getting out to here, and you're still at a high risk. And that, businesses don't want to do that. Businesses want to de-risk as fast as they can. So that's really what these phases are about, is de-risking. So in the inception phase, you do work that will encourage you to believe that there is a business case, that the stakeholders have bought into it, and that you think you're going to be, that the project's feasible. And in the elaboration phase, you do de-risk it further. You convince yourself, yes, you can actually build it, and so on. And during construction and the transition, you're not de-risking as much because, once you get to the end of the elaboration phase, you're pretty confident you can build the thing. So it's just a question of, can you hire the software engineers you need and that sort of thing. So you can see that one of the appeals of this from a business perspective is this reduction, much more rapid reduction in risk of following this kind of approach. That's the idea anyway. And it has gained many adherents. So a lot of people do use the rational unified process or some variant of it. So, those are phases, a sequence of phases. Kind of orthogonal to that, there are 9 activities that are carried on in the unified process. And 6 of them are engineering workflows, and 3 of them are support workflows. So the engineering workflows are modeling the business, so that's what is the business reason, what are the business processes that are going on, requirements, analysis and design, implementation, test and deployment. We know what all these things are. I'm not going to go through that because that's what we've been going through. But so these are the sorts of activities that go on in the phases, and they're supported by the kinds of things we've talked about, configuration, change management, project management. We haven't really talked about project management, but that's a whole sort of area of study and practice in its own right, and there are tools to support that as well. And the environment in which all this takes place, so what kind of processes do you have in place? So the way these two things work together, you can see in this slide. So if we have these phases, so time running left to right, we have these phases: inception, elaboration, construction, transition. And you can see that if we look, say, at requirements gathering, it's not the case in this idea that all the requirements are gathered in the early part and then there's nothing goes on down here. You can see there's more requirements gathering going on throughout the project. It's just at a lower pace, and it tails off in the transition. And project management is something obviously that needs to be occurring throughout the whole project. So there's a separation between these phases and the activities that go on. And the shape of a diagram like this is going to depend on the exact project that you're working on. It's going to be different in different projects. Although business modeling is going to tend to be concentrated towards early phases and requirements and so on, you know, that it's going to have that kind of characteristic. And the third aspect of unified process is that there are six fundamental best practices that are identified. And again, these are things that we've looked at. So develop software iteratively, make sure the customer prioritizes what goes, you know, what goes in the first iteration. You ask the customer what's most important, and so on, and you gradually get to the less important with later iterations. Be explicit about managing your requirements, you know, analyze their impact before you commit to them. Use component-based architectures so that you can reuse components so that maintenance is easier. Model the software using UML. So UML is mandated by the unified process. Test. Do configuration management and so on, revision control. So those are the six best practices. And, you know, after a while, all of these kind of practices should just become automatic. I mean, you've heard most of these things so many times now in these lectures that you're probably looking at it going, yeah. And, you know, and once you've been out working as software engineers for a while, you don't even, you know, you just know this is the way things should work. When we get to Agile, then we'll, you know, there's a slightly different focus. Okay, so that was the unified software process, and then I'm just going to end up with talking a little bit about the personal software process. So this is something that you may hear about, and it's a discipline, a sort of individual-based discipline for software engineering, where everything we've talked about up to now has been about teams. So the idea with the personal software process is that you identify methods and practices from large projects that can be used by individuals. And then you use some of those while you're developing small programs. So it's a way of kind of easing into the methods and practices that you'll need for larger programs. And the idea is to structure those so they can be gradually introduced and then provide lots of exercises for practicing these in an educational setting. So that's kind of the idea, and it allows you to gradually become more and more sophisticated about how you do software engineering. So it's got explicit development phases, you know, separating design from coding. It has lots of forms to fill in if you do it properly. So recording what you do, how much time you spend on things, recording defects, and so on. So the idea is that if you follow this process, you'll identify where you have sort of weak areas and where you need to improve, and it can track improvements and so on. So you can read more about this on the SCI's website. That's the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon. And there's tool support for it. It's a relatively high ceremony process, so, you know, all those forms to fill out, which seems like overhead for individuals and small projects. But it's basically, the idea is it will be used as a training process for people who end up expecting to use something like UP. It's kind of an easy way in. And TSP is a variant on this, which it's a kind of intermediate form between the personal and unified process. So as you can tell, there are a lot of different approaches to this. And you know, one of the things that if you go become a software engineer as a job, you know, you'll need to be able to talk about some of these things and say, yeah, I followed this, or I did that, or I studied it. So it's worth knowing what these different acronyms mean. But Agile takes a very different approach, and we'll go over that in the next lecture. And there's also something called the Process Maturity Model, from Software Engineering Institute. This is CMMI is the Capability Maturity Model Integration, and that's used to model how you can improve your process. So it's kind of a meta activity. Okay, so that's all I have to say about the kind of more organized and structured and heavyweight software engineering processes, and we'll get on to Agile next time. It'd be a good idea for you to look around on the web and you know, read up a little bit more about these, the ones that mentioned Waterfall, Spiral, the Rational Unified Process, the PSP, and the Capability Maturity Model. Okay, I think that's it. I haven't had a chance to have a look. You definitely seen it. Right, okay. I'll take a look. I don't think I can do it just here. I just haven't had time to respond to you. I'll check if it's there and I missed it, and I'll let you know that.
I'm in the ground, right? Yeah.
Something else. I mean, do you still have it?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll send you an email. Okay.